Irish get such amazing, fascinating, and famous guests. Dr. Jabe Albanese received the Frieda Adler Distinguished Scholar Award from the American Society of Criminology. That is quite the honor. Sisters in Crime really changed my career. We taught gambling and embezzlement. Ethics, of course. There is no such thing as a small ethical decision, according to Dr. Albanese. Love that. Also, how about movies that bring fraud to life? Succession is back this week on the small screen. Not sure if I'm going to watch it. They are a terrible group of people. Do you watch Succession? Well, let's get started with Jay. I'm so excited to have Dr. Jay Albanese with Fraudish today. And I looked online. We've been connected for almost 7 years. And I've seen you like in Zoom classes, like one in Portugal, and all of a sudden there you are. And like, and then another one recently. And so I reached out, and you guys are so lucky to be able to hear Jay, because he's okay. I found this out during my due diligence. You were the first PhD graduate from Rutgers School of Criminal Justice. Is that right?
That is correct. How do you like that?
That's a big deal.
That's way back in the 1980s. Some of us remember the 1980s.
Yeah. And you are, I'm going to say, you're like good friends with Dr. Frieda Adler.
Absolutely. She was a professor of mine back in the day, and we've remained, you know, good friends for many years. And I was thrilled last year that there's an award by the American Society of Criminology, the Frieda Adler Distinguished Scholar Award. And I received that award last year. So there's really nothing more fulfilling than to get an award named in honor of one of your, you know, distinguished professors.
Yeah, that is so cool. I got to talk to her on the phone in like 2014. I sent her like a LinkedIn message, and she goes, give me a call. And I couldn't, like, and we had this 45-minute conversation. And, you know, I have a soft spot for academia because my late husband was a professor, and you professors do amazing work, and you get a niche down unlike a lot of people.
Well, I guess that is the one advantage. You get to study particular issues in depth, whereas most of us in life are, you know, just hitting speed bumps left and right. And it's much more difficult to devote a whole lot of time on any particular topic. And it's just like being in the investigation game. You take cases as they come. And some are similar, but most are completely different from the others. So it's, everybody's life is that way. There's always a little bit of chaos underneath. For academics, the chaos is all of the students and then all of the administrators who want things from you. But that's just the way, I think if you looked at any given career, there's always pressures from below and pressures from above.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So also when I was doing my due diligence, I saw that you have something that is warm to my heart, but not in a good way, is gambling. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute, but we're going to start with our speed round. When you hear the word fraud, what do you think of?
Larceny by trick. Larceny by trick is the common law definition of fraud. So fraud is stealing by tricking somebody. As a matter of fact, I did a very, well, I'm violating your lightning round rules, but
no, that's okay.
I did a paper in the early 2000s on fraud. I argued that fraud will be the characteristic crime of the 21st century, arguing that if you look at the 20th century, larceny was the characteristic crime of the 20th century. Why? Well, when you look at reported crimes over the 20th century, self-report studies, FBI crime statistics, larceny was by far the most common crime. And all larceny is taking property of another by stealth. You take it secretly in some way. I grab your purse when you're not looking. That's the essence of larceny. Whereas in the 21st century, as you know better than most, we increasingly put our property into the custody of others. And therefore, and then of course, somebody invented the internet. And it's now become much easier to steal from people you've never met. Whereas before, it involved, you had to be somewhere in proximity to that person to steal. And that's no longer the case. That's made this, a very, troubling times, I think, fraud wise.
Absolutely. And, a lot of people look at all the people who get burglar alarm systems and, they guard dogs or whatever it is. And it's like, you're not going to be a victim of street crime. You're going to be a victim of sweet crime.
Yeah, absolutely. You're much more vulnerable at your laptop than, you are at the front door. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Back to our lightning round, which isn't a lightning round, but it never is. So, and I can't wait for your answer on this one. Who makes better embezzlers, men or women?
Better. Boy, that is really hard to say. I think the issue is they do it for very different reasons. There's been some studies of embezzlers over time. And, male embezzlers, of course, there are exceptions, but by and large, the largest group of male embezzlers do it to cover for a non-shareable financial problem. They're gambling, they're drinking, they're doing something. They've got another family on the side, whatever the deal. So it's a non-shareable problem and they're stealing this, and all embezzlers say, well, I'll pay it back, but that's always the rub. But when you look at interviews with women who've been caught embezzling, the reasons are overwhelmingly trying to keep the family together. They're trying, things are not going well. Maybe the husband is a drinker or a gambler or whatever's going on, but many times they're doing it for much less selfish reasons. They're doing it for family reasons, whereas men are doing it primarily for selfish reasons. So, I just found it very, very different. There's a clear gender difference in the motivations for embezzlement on the male versus female side.
And your picture on LinkedIn shows you in a pink shirt.
Yes. Yeah. And I have been to men's clothing stores and I'll ask for a pink shirt and a number of them don't even carry pink shirts. Can you believe that? Which seems just kind of odd to me. You just can't wear a white shirt every day, right? You can't wear a blue shirt every day. Why would you not wear a pink shirt now and again? And anyway, we have to have an investigation of that sometime.
Yeah. Do you know pink used to be the color for men until I believe it was the 50s?
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a whole book on it. Yeah, it's very interesting. So you paused when I said, who makes better embezzlers, men or women? And I'm going to put words in your mouth and correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
You paused because men steal more, but women steal for longer periods of time. Would that be your sort of pause?
Yeah, I haven't looked at the data on that very hard, but that would seem to make sense for me. Men tend to have larger appetites. In other words, they tend to dig themselves in bigger holes. Whereas the female embezzlers, and as I said, most of which did it to help with a family problem, basically keeping the family together, they would tend to steal what they need rather than what they want. Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of start my presentations with all my suspects have been women, except for one man who stole like a woman. And the whole thing was he had a sick child and he just wanted life at home to be a little bit easier. And he didn't, he only stole like $40,000. Yeah. But whereas my male embezzlers have been way up there and get caught relatively quickly.
Yeah. And of course, it's much easier to set off the red flags when large amounts are missing. So that makes it much easier to catch them.
So when I had this conversation with Dr. Adler, many years ago, and I was just honored, she told me there will never be a Bernice Madoff in her lifetime because women aren't at the level.
I don't agree. Simply because the interesting thing is the Bernie Madoff, obviously, arguably the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. But when you look at how he set up his scam, a lot of it involved, you know, friends and connections, and he was ripping off people. He wasn't just ripping off strangers. He was ripping off friends, anybody who had money. He ripped off, you know, the commentator Larry King, and who he knew socially, you know. So, I mean, it really was a pathological scene. But I can see that happening only because, you know, when I look at the case of Elizabeth Holmes, who with the Theranos case, where and by the way, all your listeners should watch that documentary. I believe it's an HBO documentary called The Inventor on what she did. But she was head of the company. So there weren't that many, you know, when Frieda Adler wrote her book, Sisters in Crime, that was in the 70s. And she made some compelling points and really changed the whole direction of criminology. But now we have women in these positions of authority. So she pulled off a major fraud, of course, until she was caught. And it's a great story. So I would argue that Bernie Madoff's scheme was larger in size. Hers was no small potatoes. This was a major fraud where she was advertising a product to get investors, and the product did not work. It was a blood test thing, but she managed to scam people just by telling lies, and that's pretty much what Bernie did as well about investment returns.
Okay, which leads us to, and you know, my guests are so amazing because you like lead me to these paths. Okay, you have a book out, and I want to read. Okay, so the book is "We Are Not as Ethical as We Think We Are: Conversations About Low Visibility Decisions That Corrupt Government, Business, and Ourselves." And it was in November of 2020. Mm-hmm. And I love the quote: "There is no such thing as a small ethical decision."
Yes. And I believe that with all my heart. And as a matter of fact, I teach ethics at the university, both an undergraduate class and a graduate class. And I teach it to most of the students are people in criminology and criminal justice people. But the point of it is that when you have, I think ethics is the most important thing of all, right? And all ethics is, in one sentence, ethics is how you ought to behave toward others, right? I mean, that's what it's about. Because when you think about it, you know, when you're little, those people who have been around little kids know you have to tell kids, you got to stand in line. You can't push other people. You have to wait your turn. All right. These things, you're not born with these things, right? You're born as a little, you know, selfish animal, and we put the rules on you. And then we try to teach you etiquette. You know, what's the way to treat a business associate? What's the way to treat somebody on a date? All these etiquette rules. And those are, you know, etiquette is the precursor to morals. Then the precursor to morals is, what's my obligation to you if you're a complete stranger? I give my students many examples. I always say, well, for example, give me an example of a decision you make, of an action you take that does not affect anybody else. And it's hard to find one, because people will say, well, if I don't brush my teeth today, doesn't affect anybody else. I said, yeah, but if you make that a habit, it will, all right? Because all of a sudden, you're going to get all these cavities. Then all of a sudden, you're going to hit your insurance maximums. Then all of a sudden, yeah, it's going to affect, and then premiums go up. You know, and we do all the many examples, wearing a motorcycle helmet, for example. For many years, there was no laws against wearing motorcycle helmets. It's my decision as an adult, right? If I want to ride a motorcycle with a helmet. But I said, so you try to get people to think about that. Well, yeah, the problem with motorcycles is it's hard to be in a minor accident on a motorcycle. Most accidents result in hospitalization. And the worst kind of injury is, of course, a head injury. You could be incapacitated for months, years, or never come back. And those of you with health insurance know that if you get sick enough, you're going to hit all your premiums, no matter how good your insurance is, you're going to hit all your maximums, and you're not going to, and that affects pools of insurers, and it raises everybody's rates. And anyway, and that's why helmets became mandatory in most places for that reason. So the question is, every action you take affects other people, whether you think about it or not. And I go through all the major ethical perspectives to try to, you know, give people, you know, what people don't lack. Okay, quick aside, if you, when you think of, you know, who are the smartest, most accomplished people in the world, that doesn't mean they don't do stupid things, all right? We had a past a president, right? Not to pick on anybody, but look at Bill Clinton when he was in the White House, right? Very smart, accomplished guy, all right? Guy was a Rhodes Scholar, finished second in his class in law school, second, by the way, to his wife. And you know, a really bright guy. And then you say, well, how does somebody with that ability then get the position of president, get themselves elected, and then agrees or somehow engages in sex with an intern in your office? Right? That's a horrible decision, right? Under any, it's a horrible decision. All right. And I only use it to show that you can be bright by any objective measure, accomplished, well-educated, but what we don't often teach is how to make decisions. So we teach you reading, writing, arithmetic, math, science, engineering in school, but we don't do a very good job in teaching what your obligations are toward others and how to make decisions. So if I was to say to you, you know, for example, and document to you what the prospects are for going to Mars and what we might find and this and that, that doesn't tell you whether we should or not do it, right? All right, that is the judgment you have to make. And that's a separate judgment based on the cost, based on risk, based on all kinds of things. So anyway, yeah, I can go on about ethics forever, but I don't think there's anything more important in life. Because ultimately, when you talk about fraud, and people who've engaged in, you know, in embezzlement and corruption and bribery and all the various forms of fraud, it always resulted from bad decisions, and usually a series of bad decisions, not thinking appropriately about their obligations to others.
Okay, there's lots there. First off, my father-in-law, rest in peace, he was a neurosurgeon. And so he called motorcycles donor cycles. And that's how he was able to have a nice lifestyle, was because people out there not, you know, doing the right thing when they were on motorcycles. So that, you know, paid for his kids' college education, to say the least. And then, you know, there is no victimless crime. There is just none. You can't. And then lastly is, I show examples of people who have been embezzled. And I can show you a rocket scientist who was embezzled, one of the first astronauts. It doesn't matter how smart you are, because there's people making decisions beneath you.
Yes. And right. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah. So like, I mean, I have an example of a guy who was a master. He's a master of the universe. And when he met me, he's like, well, I'll never have to hire you. I'm really smart. You know, I'm self-made. I pay my employees well. And fast forward like 9 months. And he's like, hey, Kelly, my office tomorrow morning, lawyers, lots of money gone. And, you know, it was a wake up call for him. It was. And so I don't care if you're up here in the org chart. And I've given her a moniker or an avatar. Her name is Gladys. Gladys is smart, and never underestimate Gladys. And Gladys might be desperate.
Right. Yeah. Right. You don't know what's going on in her life. You don't know what the deal is. Many years ago, I was, well, not all that many years ago, but some years back, I was brought in by a federal investigative agency, and I won't say which one, because they had several large scandals that had occurred among individual agents, operatives, who got themselves into trouble, usually involving money and money from the wrong people for the wrong reasons. And one of my takeaway points was, you know, their screening at the time of hire was unbelievably thorough. I mean, backgrounds, family, friends, relatives. If they got a warning for, you know, jaywalking when they were 18, that would come up. You know, they were really, it's really very thorough. But what was missing at that time anyway, I said, from the time of hire, people's lives change. All right. Things happen. There's crises in life, crises with, you know, spouses, children, relatives, family, substance abuse, all kinds of things happen that nobody counts on, but it affects everybody all the time. And I say, what happens? You have to have a system of monitoring in there. You can't assume that somebody you hire at age, you know, 25 or 35 is going to be exactly the same person at age 40 and 50, because, you know, life is a mess.
Absolutely. I mean, I was a federal agent. We got rebackgrounded every 5 years.
Yeah.
Granted, the second, you know, the subsequent backgrounds weren't quite as strenuous as the first one, but still, I kind of saw it as like, you know, it's coming.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's got right. Yeah. But you're right. But it's one of those things, and we can't control the things that happen in our lives. I mean, unfortunately, you know, like as everybody listening to this knows, you can't go through life without running across major crises, some of which directly involve you, some of which are family, friends, health, or, you know, and dealing with it is difficult. And this just causes a lot of stress in life.
Yeah. So now this leads to one of my favorite, I'm going to say favorite topics, but it's really not because I hate it. gambling and embezzlement. And you've written a lot and researched a lot. So Tell our audience like anything you want them to know. And then, of course, I will have questions.
Sure. Well, first, what everybody knows. The first thing, when the Powerball jackpot hits $1 billion or something, people buy a ticket, that's fine. Ticket costs $2, right? It's a pretty harmless activity, but things that you make a habit that aren't real goods become a problem. All right. People come home from work, they have a glass of wine. That's great. You come home from work and you have a bottle of wine. It's not good, right? It isn't healthy. And it's the same with everything. And what happens with gambling and is that while the percentage of people in America who are compulsive gamblers is very small, it's under 3% in most surveys. Of course, I'm worried a little bit about sports gambling on phones now because everyone I know, I think on planet Earth now, has a smartphone in their hand. And if you make it that easy, it's much more easy to make it habit forming when it's always right there in front of you. And what has happened now with that interaction, things now make it even easier. So, for example, if you like hockey, you all know that whoever scores the first goal, their odds of winning go way up. So now there's all these in-game bets you can make. So you bet, you know, the usual line. And then once the first goal is scored, they shift the odds again in order to bring you back in if your team is down or up. And so when you give all those kinds of incentives, I do worry about that simply because I did a lot of studies of casino development, and there's been no major impact of casino development on compulsive gambling, things like that. And although all the smart states have written into their gambling laws, yeah, we're going to have casino development, but X percent of the profits must go toward prevention programs and treatment of compulsive gamblers. And that's why when you hear all the ads, right, it's required for them to say at the end of the ad where to call if you think you have, a gambling problem. And of course, the thing is, gambling is based on statistics. Most people did not take or fail statistics in school. But that's just to say, when you walk into a casino and the casino looks beautiful, carpet, and I mean, it's decorated beautifully, it doesn't look that way because everybody's winning, right? It's looking that way because people are funding it. And I could talk about gambling because, depending on where you go, I mean, you know, the give back on like a slot machine is usually around 13%, although it varies quite a bit. And here I am, an academic. I mean, when I apply for a major research grant to a federal agency, the odds of getting that grant are about the same. You know, it's shockingly low. So I do have people I know in the business that say, well, who am I to talk about gambling when me applying for a big grant, you know, many times it has worse odds than playing the slots in the casino. And they are right. But the point of it is, anything you do habitually, you have to look at carefully. And it's like everybody I know, including me, has a cup of coffee in the morning. Maybe you have two. All right. Great. No, nobody cares. There's no apparent studies that show there's any harm in that. But if you're drinking like a pot a day, well, then you got to think, right? Well, is this appropriate? So, gambling is good. I've seen it work in favor of some places. The best casino developments are always the ones that are going to bring people from the outside. Those are the ones. Las Vegas is the perfect model. You take away casinos, there wasn't anything there, all right? There wasn't anything there pre-casinos. So basically, everybody who goes to Vegas makes a dedicated trip, the vast majority of whom come from outside of the state. That's exactly what you want economically. People bringing their money to Vegas, gamble, and then they go back home. And where there's been more problems is when you have things that are more regressive, where the locals are betting in their own casinos, and that's your main source of income. You can see how that isn't smart economically, because that becomes, you know, a regressive tax on locals. Also it leads much more to, you know, habitual gambling.
So my dad used to like to play the like state lottery, and he'd have tickets in his pocket all the time. And not anything crazy, like probably $10 a week at most. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, I'm just paying a little extra in taxes. And I was like, Dad, here, you just give me $10 and I'll give you back $5 and you'll think that you won. And then there's a late comedian, Louis Anderson, who lived in Vegas. And his thing was, look at the casino's house and look at your house. Who's winning? And that is my line in the sand, because I have seen it too much. I've seen it up close and personal in my family, and I won't. So I get hired and have gigs at casinos, and I'll go in and I'll have like a picture of my hand, like close to touching the slot machine. And I'm like, I won't do it. Like, yeah, it's yeah. Did you ever see the movie Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler?
Yes, I did. Yeah. No, that was well done.
I hated that movie. It made me so uncomfortable.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah. that's what I mean. You felt like you were in the middle of it.
I hated it because of the whole gambling stuff.
So. Yeah. And the thing is what everybody does. Look, if you want to go to the Disney World, I don't know what it costs to get in now, but it's got to be at least, $50 or more to get in.
I went this summer, $500 for 3 1-day tickets, no food, no parking.
Oh my God.
That's why people steal and they go to Disney, because they can't afford it on their own.
Wow. But yeah, my view is, if you want to, you know, go to Disney World, that's great, you know, but you budget it. All right. We've got X $100. We're going to spend X on stuff, and that's it. And when people go to a casino, they should think the exact same way. You know, I'm going to go to Vegas or Atlantic City or wherever it is. And you have to say, okay, I'm reserving my money and I like to gamble, but I'm, you know, $200 is it. That otherwise the budget's being blown. And people have to think the exact same way they would planning a trip anywhere when it involves gambling, I think.
So you have, and I'll put the paper in the show notes, but you did the paper on casinos and gambling in 2008. Mm-hmm. And some of the statistics kind of blew me away. The average age of casino patrons, 47. Okay, I'm past that. So mm-hmm. we're good. 56% had some college education. Mm-hmm. And 47% had college degrees.
Right.
So it's not a bunch of ding-dongs hanging out at the casino.
No. And when I was brought into a few different casino jurisdictions prior to the building of casino, worried about the impacts, they always were worried about street crime, you know? And I said, no, street crime is not going to be the problem. Look at the profile of the people you're bringing here. These are, you know, older. This is a middle-aged thing. And you know, the biggest, you know, issues are normally with your employees, maybe with your parking, if that's not set up right, things like that. But people, you know, do it. I know many people who do it as a leisure activity. So just like, you know, you or I might go to Disney World, they'll do the weekend in Vegas or whatever, which is fine as long as you're under control.
So it's funny, my late husband went to a bachelor party, and it wasn't in, I don't think it was in Vegas, but it was like Reno or Tahoe or something like that. And he had a friend who gave him $20. He had a $20 bill. And he said, I don't care how many times I come to you, you are not to give me the $20 bill. And he goes, when I leave on Monday morning, you are to give that $20 bill, not to me, to my cab driver. And sure enough, like that is one of, you know, the many things I loved about my husband was he was that person.
Yeah.
And there's a lot. And, you know, the guy is successful, college, everything like that. Yeah. At least he knew his limits, and he gave the $20 at the beginning of the weekend and said, no matter how much I beg and cry, you are not to give it to me.
Right. And, no. Which is great. Yeah, that's somebody who at least knows what their limits are. And that's just, you know, you have to be aware of yourself. We all have weaknesses. Some people have weaknesses, you know, for food. You know, they don't know when to stop or whatever it might be. But I would argue that, you know, gambling is the same way. You know, some people do crazy things. I'm going to see, you know, Rihanna in concert, and she's singing in, you know, Austin or somewhere. And you say, well, why don't you just cost it out? I mean, what's it going to cost? You know, how much do you really want to see her? So, but it's just, to me, it's the same kind of thing. You got to know what your limits are, especially within what your finances are.
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing that you are really, really good at is the whole criminologist without borders and networking. Like I said, all of a sudden we were watching Mary Dodge in Portugal, and you and I both popped up on the screen.
How do you like that? That's right. Yeah. Mary Dodge. I know her well.
I just got to spend a couple of days with her in Denver, and delightful.
Yeah. She is a scream. Yeah. She is fun. And she knows, you know, quite a bit about white collar crime.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some resources that you would recommend for like fraudish listeners who want to learn about like gambling and embezzlement, or just like, as you said, that fraud is the 21st century crime?
Yeah. Well, the first thing they have to do is read your book. Number one.
Thank you.
Number two, you know, keep up. I mean, I noticed, you know, we talked a little bit about movies earlier. The movies help bring it to life, because even I find, you know, with my students at any age, you know, I could talk about, you know, like the college admission scandal that hit in multiple states, people, basically wealthy people bribing their way to get junior into school. But that Varsity Blues documentary on Netflix that came out last year, you know, is just beautifully, you know, in an hour and a half, lays it all out, basically through interviews with people who were involved in one capacity or other. But it helps you realize how, oh my God, there's no big business in that. These are just regular people who are connected with money that basically defrauded an entire system. So there's plenty of those. The Bernie Madoff documentary on, I guess that was HBO, The Wizard of Lies. That's very good.
I love that one.
A few years ago. But it's good to be up on that because you can see their methods. You can see what the thinking was. You get a very good taste of it. There was one small budget movie or independent movie came out in 2018 called Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh, I love that.
Isn't that, it was cute. It starred Melissa McCarthy, and she's always very watchable, but it's a true story. And she's basically a writer for a living, not doing very well. And she starts forging letters by dead authors and selling them because there's by a dead famous author, and how she got into it and then tries to get out of it. But so whether it's Melissa McCarthy on a small scale, and then you can go, you know, to big scale, Wolf of Wall Street or The Big Short, of major corporate investor fraud on the biggest scale. That's one thing, but you see, even if you're looking at The Big Short, The Wolf of Wall Street.
My favorite movie ever.
Really? And it's great because there's many, you know, very famous actors in there. But if you pull it all apart, I think the thing that comes more is because people say, well, it's a big, you know, corporate fraud. Well, no, it's individuals making horrible decisions, usually self-interested, selfish decisions, and how things sort of spiral together. And how if people, if you get the message from the top that it's okay, you're gonna do it. And some of the big pharmaceutical scandals about sales practices for selling opioids and things like this. So whether it's, you know, the individual stuff that you see in, you know, Melissa McCarthy, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Or the, you know, Varsity Blues scandal, you know, a non-corporate related individual. So when we hit the headlines too often, we think, oh God, that's a big corporate fraud, that nasty corporation. I get that. But what these documentaries do is say, oh my God, this is individuals. These are a bunch of individuals. Sure, they work for the same people or for the same types of companies who either conspire together or individually. So it's all a series of individual decisions. And to me, that's the most important thing for people to see, because the imagination of people to find ways to victimize others has increased just because the opportunities have increased. And so I'm really a big believer in people keeping up in current events. If you can't read everything, watch these documentaries. They're being made, all the time now. And people said, well, the Elizabeth Holmes things on the Theranos corporate fraud. It's great because, you know, the HBO documentary, which is only a few years old, shows how all of a sudden how one person can put pressure on people to all of a sudden they're doing unethical and illegal things. So
Did you know I teach a class called Fraud in Pop Culture?
Oh, really? No, I did not know that. Really?
Oh my God, it's so much fun. And like, and you know what's so much fun about it? So show clips of movies and things like that. I Care a Lot is in it. Have you seen I Care a Lot?
No, which one is that now?
Oh, it's about guardianship. Oh, you got to see it. Oh, so good. And again, there's twists. It's great. Mm-hmm. But Can You Ever Forgive Me is in it. Mm-hmm. But people love it. And the reason, this is a long story to get to it, but I'll make it quick. My husband was an educational psychologist and taught teachers how to teach. And his thing was using film to teach history. And so several years ago, I'm looking at him and like, we watch the Discovery Channel. We watch the History Channel. Yet we make kids read books. And his was like, no, And so I took his idea of like using film to teach about fraud. And it's a really popular course. And I mean, I don't have enough time to put all the clips in it because, and everyone brings up movies. So yeah. And he proved that, you know, students pay good attention when they're seeing clips.
Well, I do have to admit, I do not teach an in-person class without showing at least 1 5-minute video in that class. For that same reason, it shocks everybody back into reality. But every, you know, we live in a time of video. Video is a great communicator. So to me, yeah, that's terrific. And in ethics, I use a million scenarios, and every scenario is based on a real life event of people making questionable decisions. So no, I to me, all that is very, very useful.
Yeah, it's just like people love it, and there's always great music. But and the funny thing is you know, Hollywood gets ripped off. Like, yeah. I mean, I have examples of where Hollywood gets ripped off, but Hollywood knows that fraud is big money, and people want to see it. So
right, and you know when you think about it, the whole premise for soap operas back in the day, now they've become reality shows, is about people mistreating other people, oftentimes either to rip them off or to extort them or blackmail them or some whatever the deal is. And of course, as you know, the police procedural investigation show is the most successful form of television since it was founded. I mean, I challenge anybody to tell me how many NCIS shows there are. And before that, it was Hill Street Blues, and Law and Order is still going on in various versions. And people like the bad behavior, and then discovering the bad behavior. It's there's something I think just intuitively interesting about it.
You know what I am looking so forward to, because The Big Short is literally one of my all-time favorite movie, and Michael Lewis, I adore. I've seen him in person and I adore him, but you know, he just spent the past 6 months with Sam Bankman-Fried.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. And so there'll be a book, there will be a movie. I can't wait to see what he does with it.
No, that's a fascinating case because, and you know, we're talking about the crypto exchange guy who's been indicted, and he was one of the good guys in the crypto business. He was donating money and testifying before Congress about what crypto can do. But then it turned out it was a house of cards, apparently. So we'll have to see what happens there. But that will be very interesting.
Yeah, just because I love his writing. And, you know, his first book, Liar's Poker, I used to play Liar's Poker when I worked at the Chicago Board of Trade when it was quiet time. Everyone would pull out their dollar bills and play Liar's Poker. So kind of crazy. Well, so, Jay, kind of closing up here, what haven't I asked you that you want to get out to the audience?
Oh, there's many things. I just want... For me, I guess the most important thing is that fraud is central to most bad behavior that's going on, because most bad behavior is going on. People are trying to get something or get over on somebody, which is the essence of fraud. And fraud relies on tricking somebody out of it one way or the other, whether it's an investment fraud or a scheme or whatever it might be. I did an analysis in an article just recently looking at all federal cybercrime cases prosecuted over a full calendar year. And guess what? When you look at all those cases, I looked at what the underlying crimes were, you know, because cybercrime just means, you know, they used, you know, computers or electronic devices to commit it, but it doesn't say what they did. When you look at that, though, so over a whole year, 45% of them were fraud-based crimes. So that's far and away the largest category. The next biggest category was, you know, sexual exploitation kinds of things, you know, stalking and porn and so forth. And all the others were much less than that. So when people say, oh, God, cybercrime is a big problem, when you look at actual cases, that means when you look at cybercrimes, most of those cases are fraud cases, people trying to steal and misrepresent themselves from others. One other thing, people talk about, you know, organized crime. I've done a lot of work on organized crime. A lot of the scams, the big frauds, involve insiders and outsiders to companies, corporations, sometimes political corruption, insiders and outsiders. When you look at it, it is very similar to organized crime schemes. There's some good stuff written out there. And last, you know, human trafficking, right? One of the newer crimes on the map. Human trafficking was really invented in the U.S., you know, 20 years ago with the human trafficking law. But the point to keep in mind is a major element of human trafficking, obviously there's the coercion part of it, but fraud is a huge part of human trafficking. We did a study looking at all published research that had done actual interviews with victims or offenders of human trafficking around the world. And a shockingly high proportion of them involve fraud. That is, how do you get someone involved in trafficking? All right. Most trafficking is some form of either sexual exploitation or labor exploitation or both. And when you look at it, it always involves a misrepresentation of, because people who get themselves in these circumstances usually are desperate, right? They're usually coming, they're usually pushed rather than being pulled into it. And you come to an agreement. Years ago, when I was in Eastern Europe, you would open the English language newspaper and you would say, we see ads, meet a Western gentleman, become a British nanny, all these things, these ads. And the people who responded to those ads were not stupid. They were just desperate, right? There was no work. They're trying to support their family or their child or their parents, whatever it was. And they said, look at, if I can get over to the UK or some other Western country, the US, I'll just make my way. I'll find my way. I just got to get over there. And of course, what happened far too often is that the original agreement they had with the ultimate trafficker was changed. All of a sudden, they take your passport somewhere in the trafficking path and say, now you work for me. The price went up. You thought you were paying me $5,000. You have to pay me $20,000 to pay that off. You have to do this, this, and this. So the point is, fraud is at the basis of human trafficking the same way as it's a big element in cybercrime, and the same way it's an important element of organized crime as well. So it's really a cross-cutting topic that I think deserves more attention.
Yeah, and we have optimism bias. We don't think bad things will actually happen to us, more so than we think good things will happen to us, which have you seen the new documentary about the guy and the Sarah Lawrence students?
No, I have not seen that yet.
I haven't seen it yet. My friend binged it the other day. I don't know if I can watch it because it's so disturbing.
That's very disturbing. When I saw the newspaper articles originally, I was really disturbing. Really disturbing, because that's I don't know how this guy got away with that kind of, you know, coercion, at elite school.
Can you imagine sending your kid to a school like that and then having them I can't even begin to imagine.
No, that would be a parent's nightmare for sure.
Yeah. Okay, my final question is, this catches some people off guard, what's the last thing you Googled before you came on the podcast?
The last thing I Googled? I don't recall what I Googled. I did not Google the weather in Oregon, although I should have. And I did see on the news today about Eastern Oregon seceding and going to Idaho. God. And I said, there's drama everywhere, sometimes way too much drama in life. And we're looking for a little bit less drama. But I mean, for me, the takeaway is, you know, as you say, people have to be careful, because when you look at cybercrime and look at human trafficking, you look at white collar crime, it's overwhelmingly fraud. people trying to get over on you financially. So you got to be really careful.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is, it's like people don't really relate to Bernie Madoff or Enron, but they do relate to all this other stuff because it happens on Main Street.
Absolutely. One of the cases I use in class was, you know, the personal, the protection loans during COVID for small businesses that were going under during COVID. You could apply to get this money. And this one case prosecuted by the feds, ultimately, you know, here's a man and a woman applying for this money, saying, yes, we have a wedding photography business. We employ 20 people. You know, our annual budget is X million. But anyway, they got some millions from the government, 5 million, 10 million, whatever it was. Anyway, it was all a lie. They got the money. They bought a Tesla. They, you know, bought some high-end property in Florida. You know, all these kinds of things. And I said, okay, well, this is just stealing, right? Fraud by misrepresentation of who you are and what you did. But secondly, you know, they had no employees. All that was just a lie. But because of the push of COVID, the checking didn't come after the money had come. So you say, but I said, what makes it worse is the complete lack of ethics. This is money designed for people whose businesses were failing. There are people who were really desperate. And here's people, don't give a damn about those people. I'm just going to get this money so I can buy my Tesla or whatever. So it's fraud, but it's fraud plus. It's fraud plus that unethical outlook of not caring about others. And that bugs the heck out of me.
Well, we are going to not leave on a depressing note. Okay. Are you reading anything fun right now?
Reading anything fun? No, I'm in the middle of a semester, so I'm reading academic stuff and about ethics and white collar crime. And a colleague and I are doing a presentation next month at a conference on deferred prosecution agreements in white collar crime cases and corporate crime cases. So we've been doing a lot of work on that.
Well, I can't thank you enough. This has been so awesome. I know you're in the middle of the semester. It's really, really busy. But like the fact that you use movies and we talk fraud and pop culture and gambling, this was, I'm honored, truly.
Well, very good. I appreciate you having me. And I hope the folks out there realize who you are and the contributions that you have made as well.
Oh, that's so sweet. Connected with Jay, you should. For my podcast listening this past week, I listened to Mahzarin Banaji on Hidden Brain. You know how much I love Hidden Brain. Her story and her work on implicit bias is a must listen. We all have biases and they affect us and the world around us, and it is so incredibly interesting and incredibly important. She has done work with law enforcement that as investigators, I think you will find fascinating. Have a great week. Get outside and listen to a podcast.